House come to order. We are at that order of business. Reports from standing committees.
Mr. Speaker, Committee Number 1, Judiciary, to whom was referred House Bill 54, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Barbudo, Prechtel, Brown, Kennedy, Green, Crone, Nicholas, Beasley, Throne. Signed, Representative Brown, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your Committee Number 1, Judiciary, to whom was referred House Bill 63, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Barbudo, Prechtel, Brown, Kennedy, Green, Crone, Nicholas, Beasley, Throne. Signed, Representative Brown, Chairman.
We're at that order of business. Bills on second reading. The first bill for our consideration is House Bill 8.
House Bill 8, introduced by the Labor Committee, an act relating to the administration of government regarding the Department of Workforce Services consolidation.
Chairman Harvey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Bill Number 8 do pass.
No.
No.
You don't have an amendment, do you? Oh, I thought you had an amendment. That's all right. There are no amendments on this, so House Bill 8 having been read two separate times, the question is, shall the bill be read a third time, hearing no objection? It is so ordered. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 9.
House Bill 9, introduced by the Labor Committee, an act relating to unemployment insurance.
House Bill 9, having been read two separate times, the question is, shall the bill be read a third time? Hearing no objection, it is so ordered. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 14.
House Bill 14, introduced by the Judiciary Committee, an act relating to civil procedure, wrongful death representative.
House Bill 14, having been read two separate times, the question is, shall the bill be read a third time? Hearing no objection, it is so ordered. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 32.
House Bill 32, introduced by the Corporation Committee, an act relating to the state legislative districts, redistricting of the legislature.
Representative Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I move second reading amendment number 1 to House Bill 32. Ask for your favorable consideration. Ladies and gentlemen, I appreciate this opportunity to kind of explain a little bit about House District 47, some of the process we went through this summer, and then present my second reading amendment. And if we are ready for some... excuse me for a minute, Mr. Speaker, while we get the screen ready.
Might as well not waste your efforts for a second.
Wait.
No, but I mean, let's let them come up and then you can... And this works...
That...
Right there. so you can show what you're talking about.
Okay. Well, again, thank you, Mr. Speaker, and ladies and gentlemen, friends and neighbors. I bring you second reading amendment, which changes some of the internal boundaries within Senate District 11, which is House District 47 and House District 15. This map is actually very telling to for everyone. I just want to give you a few brief summaries, examples of just what the vast territory of House District 47 will look like. We've been hearing stories that perhaps House District 47 will be the largest House district in the West. What it looks like right there is a little over 12,000 square miles and a little over 200 miles east to west, 99 miles, about 100 miles north to south. Again, some of the history, the challenges as we got to where we are today, I would be remiss without mentioning to you one of the outliers, the anomalies that we had to endure in House District 47 with regard to the penitentiary sitting within the city limits of Rawlins. It has absolutely skewed. Maybe could you zoom in on Rawlins for me, please? We had a census block, Mr. Speaker, within the city limits of Rawlins, over 600 people. Just everyone know that exceeds the size of all but one of the towns, the 10 towns within my district right now. It has made it somewhat challenging in order to fit the lines to agree with all of the residents in this vast territory. We have had many challenges as we went through. And again, I could use my pointer here. Right in here is the census block for the penitentiary. Found out that we are not allowed to split census blocks. After arriving at the plan that we see here today, if we could slide that, oh, there we go. With what you see in that picture over on the right, that is the area that includes the town of Sinclair, right in that area there. And of course, everyone knows that to make Sinclair a part of House District 15, where it is not today, just basically on making all the numbers balance out. And as a result of part of my campaign promises, I always do pre-session and post-session community meetings. Earlier in January, I held a meeting in Sinclair, advertised meeting to talk about legislative issues as well as other interests that the citizens have. And they have this great little coffee clutch in Sinclair Wednesday mornings. A lot of good friends there, and I just love these people. And it was unanimous, except for one person, that they wanted to remain in House District 47. The one person who didn't really mind was actually visiting from Rawlins, of course. And there was about 30 people there. Of course, I was left with how do I incorporate their feelings into the redistricting plan in front of me today. Of course, I felt I have a duty, a responsibility to these people that are now currently in my district. And I wanted to represent them first as best I could. Of course, I investigated several different alternatives. The first one I did try to pursue was figuring out a way I could realistically, legally, and abide by our Constitution to split that census block. Believe me, it could have worked out very easily and compatible with all of our other interests, except for the fact that our Constitution realized we had to, or mandated we had to use pure raw census block data, and I was unable to split that those numbers. Through this whole process, I was made aware that the representative, my colleague from Rawlins, had a meeting with residents of Wamsutter. And there was a desire from the residents and local government of Wamsutter to be aligned with House District 15, which, of course, right now is Rawlins. And armed with that knowledge, started working on a way to where we could do perhaps what we're calling a swap. And now perhaps you could bring up the map that shows what my amendment will do to adjust and to address not only the concerns I heard from citizens that I represent, but also conversations that citizens, residents of Wamsutter had expressed to the representative in House District 15. What we see right here now, obviously you can see the new 15 area in this area here. It's the Wamsutter block. The town of Wamsutter tucked in nicely down in here. We drew that line to include quite a large area of zeros, but it seemed more convenient to do it that way as far as recognizing voting districts. And then over here, here's Rawlins. The boundaries around Rawlins are identical to the current draft or the current Committee of the Whole bill that was voted on yesterday. Those boundaries remain unchanged. Now, Mr. Speaker, you will see the connection that we have between the town of Rawlins and the Wamsutter block is a thin line called Interstate 80. Initially, we did draw a broader swath through there. There are many little blocks in there that have zeros. The reason you see the presentation here today that shows the connection between these two areas to make them contiguous, I am addressing the concerns of my county clerk, who thought it would, once we realized that it was legal to have a connection like this, that in the future, if in fact people started living in and around north and south of the interstate, perhaps it would be easier to sort out the voting districts if we maintained the connection, if you will, between Rawlins and that Wamsutter block by just the interstate. Recognizing it is probably a very unique situation, Mr. Speaker, although I tried to outline some of the other unique qualities that we see in House District 47 and 15 as it is right now. And I guess I would let that set for now, Mr. Speaker, and take questions.
Anyone wish to speak on second reading amendment number 1 to House Bill 32? Representative Burkhart.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I noticed a lot of your reactions were the same as mine when I saw this for the first time, which was, wow. I really don't know what to think. I can say the people in Sinclair have told me they can't understand why they weren't included with Rawlins at the last redistricting. People in Wamsutter have said they feel they have a community of interest with Rawlins. But to use the interstate right-of-way as a voting, or rather, I'm sorry, as a census block to connect two almost odd areas, I don't know if I can really agree with that. I mean, you could take that concept, and I guess I could end up going to Gillette maybe and taking some people up there and help them with some of the issues they seem to have. The people in Wamsutter have indicated a desire to be associated with Rollins in some way. The people I've talked to personally in Sinclair have indicated to me that they feel they should have been included with Rollins. I do not have an objection to the way the plan currently is that was voted on yesterday, which keeps Rollins as one entity with Sinclair. So this is kind of odd to me, and I guess just on the looks of it, and maybe it's aesthetics, it doesn't look right. You can decide for yourself what you think about the plan. The county clerks have told me that it fits their needs because it keeps the voting districts intact. It doesn't split districts. But again, it's a matter of what's the right thing to do. I guess that just doesn't look right to me. And I would like to hear from some of the other people on how others feel about this, but it just doesn't feel right to me. Doesn't seem like the right way to do things.
Anyone else for their first time? Chairman Brown?
Well, Mr. Speaker, I look at that map and I have to tell you, most of that area I've been through horseback, and there's not a lot out there. There really isn't. And one time my friend built a fence right up the Carbon-Sweetwater County line, and I said, fine, now we're going to spend all our time riding around looking for a gate. So that area is large, but you could actually slim that down and just take a little thread that ran down the interstate and hooked in Wamsutter, and I don't think it wouldn't make a difference to 300 or 400 people. I don't think it'd make a difference to that many. So while it does look odd, perhaps on the map, when you get down to the, and I don't know if there's a way to show the census blocks in there or not, but there's, aside from, well, okay, there's some dots in there. I don't know what those mean, but the big number of people, most of those are horses, I think. There's a couple elk out there. The big population parts in Wamsutter. So I don't, those are zeros, okay. So if you were to slim that down, it wouldn't look so enormous and it wouldn't change the numbers of people. And I guess I think that Wamsutter probably has more of a community of interest with Rollins than Sinclair does from what I know of the area. So I see no objection to it.
Anyone else for their first time? First time? Second time? Representative Stewart. Oh, first time? Representative Yagi. Step right up.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. As we've been going through this, and I've sat through all of the redistricting, listening to the people of Rollins who came, their clerk, this plan, I guess that's about the same thing that I have thought. I do know that there are some people in Rock Springs that are associated with Wamsutter, and I think the school district can go either way at once. Some of the folks from Rock Springs have a close alliance with Wamsutter, so I don't think we need to paint it all like everything from Wamsutter goes to Rollins. I think there are some ties going to Rock Springs. As the committee looked at this, and just myself, I think I would recommend we stay with the plan that we currently have. Thank you.
Anyone else for their first time? First time, second time, Representative Stewart.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
came up the issue of communities of interest. Again, I'd like to emphasize the fact that we did hear from Wamsutter residents. I did not personally hear, but I can understand how a lot of their shopping, where they go for a weekend or whatever, is probably Rawlins, and I can respect that. Typically, the comments I heard from residents in Sinclair, clearly they may have some economic ties to Rawlins, very close. As far as how they felt, where they aligned themselves of community interest, the way they described it to me, they felt more aligned with perceptions on the state policy issues, along with residents, and they name them off: Hannah, Elk Mountain, Medicine Bow, mining communities. And a lot of the people that go to this great coffee clutch I go to on Wednesday mornings have some summer homes in Encampment. So clearly the ties are for those smaller towns in Carbon County. And this is the truth. What you're seeing here today is not the first iteration. Ladies and gentlemen, I understand that this is a unique way to draw this out. Again, what I did, what we're seeing here today, is I tried to incorporate as many thoughts on this as I could, and I did want to represent my county clerk through this. And this is what you see here today. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
All those in favor of second reading amendment number 1 to House Bill 32, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Second reading amendment number 1 to House Bill 32 has been defeated. Representative Byrd.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I brought an amendment that would have rolled back and did some surgical execution all the way back through our January 19th meeting, because I feel very strongly that we gave the entire state an opportunity for input. We exhausted many, many man hours from our local commissioners, county clerks, and just about everybody who had a stake in the game at ground level. And then we had more meetings with the committee, with our esteemed colleagues up here. And it appears that we're choosing to disregard the recommendations of the people who do the groundwork down to the bottom level and come up with our own plan. And that would be the will of this body. But I think in doing that, we're overlooking all of those people who genuinely tried to make this work, tried to come up with a plan. Far be it, it's not going to be perfect. There are going to be parts that everybody likes and everybody dislikes, but that's the way it is. So at this particular time, because we could drag this out forever, I'm going to withdraw my amendment, and I'm going to leave this to the will of the body. But I would like to leave this at, if we depart on these amendments, we are really setting ourselves up for some trouble here. Thank you.
Second reading amendment number 2 to House Bill 32 having been withdrawn, we are now on second reading amendment number 3 to House Bill 32. Representative Hunt.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I do bring amendment 2 to reading number 2 and ask for your favorable consideration. This is pretty much line by line, block by block, absolutely identical to yesterday. I just bring this again before you one more time to, just because I would like the opportunity to just make one more statement. One more time, once again, this bill, or this amendment does its best to stick with county lines on the east side. It kind of tries to keep some of the district compact as possible. And, tries to give some representation to the rural areas that are sort of wedged in there in the northeast corner. Beyond that, that's really all I have to say, and thank you very much.
Anyone else for their first time? First time chairman of the way.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'm going to object to the plan on two bases. We looked at it yesterday, and we rejected it quite soundly yesterday, and Western Laramie County was a complete redo without talking to any of the representatives that represented Western Laramie County. Part of it is an area that I represent currently. We had no opportunity to make any comments, so I would ask you to reject this. We've rejected it several times. I'd ask for your rejection again.
Anyone else? First time, Representative Blickery.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Speaking on and against this amendment, the same things that I mentioned yesterday. Campbell County has an exact population to have five districts with 9,227 people in each one, with a couple with 9,226. Almost perfect. Campbell County was willing to work to try to make the east side work. You can see that we were willing to go down and work with Converse County to form a district. We're still willing to, but we're not willing to be divided up into a whole lot of other districts. So please vote against this amendment. Thank you.
Anyone else for their first time? First time? For your second time? Representative Hunt. All those in favor of second reading amendment number 3 to House Bill 32, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Second reading amendment number 3 to House Bill 32 has been defeated. House Bill 32 having been read two separate times. The question is, shall the bill be read a third time? Hearing no objection, it is so ordered. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, privilege of the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. In the gallery today is a group from my hometown, and it's not very often that we get a group of people driving all the way down to Cheyenne from the boondocks. And they're the leadership group from the Gillette Area Leadership Institute, who spend a year learning about government, and they're down here to watch us in action. So, ladies and gentlemen, would you welcome the Gillette Area Leadership Institute.
And I'd like to call attention to the North Gallery, and if you would welcome my superintendent of schools from the Goshen County School District, Mr. Ray Schulte, he's here. Representative Madden.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. In the south balcony, standing, I hope, is a special distinguished visitor. Former state Senate member, former state House member. She also, incidentally, was born in the same delivery room as Representative Edmonds. However, it was several years prior to that. Every day this person wakes up lucky that she's married to me. This is my wife, Cheryl Madden.
Ma'am, I would say that 59 other members respectfully disagree. Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. On that high note, I would just suggest to you that we're into our fourth day down here, and every time I've walked through the balcony, I haven't had anybody say, gosh, it's good to see you back, how you doing? the words out of their mouth is, where's your wife? And my wife is here for the first time this session. One of our standbys, she'll stand up. That's my wife, Lynn, and she's got her knitting with her.
Representative McComey.
Well, thank you, Mr. Speaker. Privilege of the floor.
Please proceed.
Mr. Speaker, above me, in the gallery there, not way up there, but she's an angel, so. But anyway, my wife, Patricia, and my brother, Don, and his wife, Arlene, from Lander.
Welcome to the House. Chairman Corbett.
Well, Mr. Speaker. Oh, he might be hiding behind. There he comes. Mr. Speaker, it's not often. I'm going to take a little license here because we have someone here from Jackson / Thermopolis and definitely someone here from Thermopolis down here. My lucky day, 2 days in a row. And I'd like you to welcome in the right direction, West Gallery. Is the master distiller, Steve Nally and David DeFazio, one of the co-owners of Wyoming Whiskey.
All right. We're going to do a few standing committee reports.
Mr. Speaker, here, committee number 7, corporations, elections, and political subdivisions, to whom is referred House Bill 5, respectfully report same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Blickery, Byrd, Hillaway, Yagi, Croker, Patton, Roscoe, Stubson, Zwanitzer, Dan, signed representing Hillaway, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 7, corporations, elections, and political subdivisions, to whom is referred House Bill 11, respectively report same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Blickery, Byrd, Hillaway, Yagi, Croker, Patton, Roscoe, Stubson, Zwanitzer, Dan. Signed, Representative Hillaway, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 7, corporations, elections, and political subdivisions, to whom is referred House Bill 15, respectfully report same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Blickery, Byrd, Hillaway, Yagi, Croker, Patton, Roscoe, Stubson, Zwanitzer, Dan. Signed, Representative Hillaway, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 7, corporations, elections, and political subdivisions, to whom is referred House Bill 16, respectfully report same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Blickery, Byrd, Hillaway, Yagi, Croker, Patton, Roscoe, Stubson, Zwanitzer, Dan. Signed, Representative Hillaway, Chairman.
At that order of business, consideration of bills on general file, Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I move that the House resolve itself into committee of the whole.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The House is resolved into committee of the whole. Representative Croker.
And if anyone is wondering, yes, I am wearing black to mourn the death of all my bills this week. The committee of the whole will please come to order. The first bill for our consideration is House Bill 10, Game and Fish Edition Elk Licenses. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 10, introduced by Representative Moniz, an act relating to game and fish, additional elk licenses. This bill was referred to Committee Number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, which respectfully reported that they would like it to pass. Ayes, Bonner, Botten, Connolly, Davison, Yagi, McKim, McComey, Petroff, Reeder. Signed, Representative McComey, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman McComey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Chairman, excuse me. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with the recommendation that House Bill 10 do pass. There are no amendments to the bill, and I'd like to turn the bill's explanation over to its sponsor, the good gentleman from House District 46.
Representative Moniz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I mentioned earlier, this bill is an indirect result of a joint ag committee that was tasked with looking at large game damage to agriculture throughout the state. In meeting with various constituents throughout the state, the subcommittee was tasked to listen to the issues and attempt to provide some solutions to the problem. In that effort, there was a number of problems identified, many of which we felt were too extensive to bring to you during a budget session. So in short, we asked the department what we could do in the short term to help with the problem. And this bill, as you see it today, is a result of that discussion. It's truly a kind of a small cog in a big wheel of a number of solutions that we look forward to dealing with in the future. And with that, I would entertain any questions you might have on this bill.
Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman McComey's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Bill Number 10 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? House Bill 10 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 25. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 25, introduced by Representative Stepson. An act relating to real property private transfer fee obligations. This bill was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary, which respectfully was said to that they recommended that it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Barbuto, Bechtel, Brown, Kennedy, Green, Crone, Nicholas, Throne, No, Peasley. Signed, Representative Brown.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Brown?
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, do so with the recommendation that House Bill 25 do pass, and I further move the adoption of Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, and I would turn the explanation of both the bill and the Standing Committee Amendment over to the representative from Natrona County.
Representative Stepson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll take the Standing Committee Amendment 1 initially. What this did is, in the definition of what a private transfer fee is and is not, it added an additional section to clarify that fees related to conservation easements and paid to those organizations that are charged with administering conservation easements do not qualify as private transfer fees. In addition, it changed the effective date of the legislation from July 1st of this year until effective immediately, and I'll give a little more explanation on why that was done, but maybe we can vote on the amendment before we address the bill.
You have heard the motion on the Standing Committee Amendment. Are you ready for the question? Question having been called, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. The Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 has been adopted. We are back on the bill. Representative Stepson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I said in introduction, this is a sort of simplified version of a bill that came through this body last year and was sponsored by our departed colleague from Natrona County. And really, you've probably gotten some emails this morning. I've received a couple that sort of compare these to Ponzi schemes, and I'm not sure that that's an apt comparison, but they are problematic. I just want to explain a little bit about what these private transfer fees are first. And these are things that are placed into deeds, and by way of example, if you have a developer that comes in and is developing property, they may put a private transfer fee in a deed which requires that every transfer from there on out, 5% of that transfer fee be paid to whoever. It could be to the developer. It could be to a nonprofit group. It could be to Uncle Frank. It could be whoever. And so you have a situation where every time the property is sold, whatever the figure is, whether it be 5%, 1%, or a fixed sum, is paid from that transfer price to this unrelated party. These are fairly new creatures, and that's why the bill comes before you, because we had some common law and some principles in common law that prohibited these historically. That is, nationally, on some revisions of the restatements of the common law, they changed those standards so that arguably these would now be permitted under the law. But they are extremely problematic if they are allowed to go forward for a couple of reasons. First of all, and primarily, is the problems with title going down the road. And I'll just explain to you, maybe by way of an example, of the problem that arises. The transfer fee, in order to get insurable title, you have to, if you look at, when you get your title insurance, they give you a title report, you have to look at it. It has to show that all these obligations have been released along the way, that there are none of these private transfer fees due and owing. And that may be from a transfer 30 years ago, 20 years ago, you know. That problem is, and so you're forced to go back and find maybe it's LLC XYZ that was set up by the developer. You have to track down that company and see, was that in fact paid? Is there something that you can record in the record? And if you can't do that, you're not going to be able to get title insurance. You're not going to be able to transfer this property later on. This becomes even more problematic because some very clever folks based out on the East Coast have developed a way to bundle these together into securities and to sell them to third parties in the securities market. And so then you're not only going to one party. There may be a host of folks that hold the rights to these private transfer fee payments that you will never be able to track down, and you will never be able to get any sort of writing that shows, yes, it's been released. And so that makes it impossible to get sufficient title insurance on these things to transfer. And so the ultimate problem is, if we don't deal with it now, 30, 40 years down the road, we have a host of properties across the state that simply can't be sold because these private transfer fees have been placed upon them and there's no way to confirm their release. That problem with insuring title has actually been taken up by a number of the federal housing folks and agencies. Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, those guys will not actually insure properties that have private transfer fees on. So you are unable for those sorts of loans now if you have properties with private transfer fees. So even now, it's already starting. But if we delay and we don't pass something, it will get worse. So I would ask for your favorable consideration. I think the bill, actually, I'm sorry, let me walk real quickly through what the bill does. The first few pages of the bill set out the definition of what a private transfer fee is, as important as what they are not, and those typical housing association dues that you may think of, those are not private transfer fees. And what it says is it prohibits private transfer fees from the day the law is passed going forward. For those that have been adopted already, you have to record in title and make clear that there's a clear record that they exist so that the next person that buys the property knows that they're there, at least knows what they're getting. And if you don't, then they're void. So that's a fairly quick explanation, but with that, I'd take any questions on the bill.
Mr. Speaker, pro tem.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Last year, I opposed this bill for multiple different reasons, one of them being that there are legitimate uses for private transfer fees, because I've been involved in some of those, but in my community. But I really appreciate the good sponsor has pared this down. Also, that an amendment was added that covered one concern. And even though there are legitimate uses, and I'm concerned that we're taking away a tool of developers that develop neighborhoods, I certainly agree that some people, anytime you come up with a good idea, there's always that nefarious person that comes up with ways to mess it up. And certainly that has happened, not in this state, but in other states. So I would urge you to vote yes and aye on this, and and move it along. And I appreciate the hard work of the good sponsor to improve the bill from last year's bill.
Is there any other discussion on the bill?
Question having been called, all those in favor of Chairman Brown's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Bill number 25 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 25 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 52. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 52, introduced by Representative Stepson. An act relating to the establishment of private roads. This bill was referred to Committee Number 1 Judiciary, who recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Barbudo, Brown, Kennedy, Green, Crone, Nicholas, Throne. No, Rechtel, Peasley, signed, Representative Brown, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Brown?
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill Number 52 do pass. And I further move the adoption of Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, and I would turn the explanation of both the bill and the Standing Committee Amendment over to the representative from District 56.
Representative Stepson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a little bit simpler bill, a tweak to our private road statute that comes out of a case that was decided this last year. And typically, in a private road case, the party seeking the private road has to pay the costs of the case, including all the price and the costs associated with valuing that private road and the compensation that they're going to have to pay for that private road. There is a gap in the statute, however, that was shown through a court case where if, for example, you're having a road put over you and you decide that you don't agree with the price of the viewers and appraisers and you go out and get your own appraisal, even if they decide, yes, your appraisal is right, you have to pay the cost of that. The party establishing the road does not. And this just simply fixes that sort of shortfall. And so if you go out, you get an appraisal, and that appraisal is a basis for the decision of the valuation by the district court, then that's just part of the costs that are paid by the party establishing the private roads. So I really see it more as a fix than anything else. The amendment, we had a flat sort of difference. If the appraisal was 15% difference than what the viewers and appraisers had decided, that's when the compensation kicked in. This changed it to a substantial difference, and so that was the Standing Committee amendment.
Please move the amendment.
Mr. Chairman, I think Chairman Brown moved it.
Okay, my bad. You have heard the motion on the Standing Committee amendment. Chairman Korberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have a question on the amendment. And I guess my question is, I'm just not sure what you mean. How are you going to determine what substantially? I mean, who's going to make that determination? It just seems a little bit vague to me, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Green.
Representative Greer, thank you. Mr. Chairman, I rise in opposition of the amendment for the same grounds as a good chair. this is a great bill. And we had a definite term of if there was a 15% differential on that appraisal, just a real nice number that set the benchmark. This amendment takes that to substantial, which is a term of art, which my profession absolutely loves. I would prefer that we pass legislation out of this House that's more definite, and would encourage you to vote against this amendment. Thank you.
You have heard the motion on the Standing Committee amendment. Are you ready for the question? Question having been called, all those in favor say aye. Opposed? No. The Standing Committee amendment number one has failed. We are back on the bill. Is there any other discussion on the bill? Question being called, all those in favor of Chairman Brown's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Bill number 52 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 52 has passed the Committee of the Whole.
Mr. Speaker.
Representative Swanser.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Members of the 61st, mostly behind me and in the galleries, you will see this year's Leadership Cheyenne Class of 2012. If you would please welcome them to the House. And if they would stand.
The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 26. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 26, introduced by the Mineral Committee, an act relating to public works and contracts, contractor residency provisions. This bill is referred to Committee Number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development. Respectfully reports back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Byrd, Greer, Hunt, Kasparic, Lockhart, Moniz, Roscoe, Stubson, Zwanitzer, Dave, sign represent Lockhart, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Lockhart?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Bill Number 26 do pass. There are no standing committee amendments. I'd like to turn the explanation of the bill over to the good representative from House District 27, which happens to be my lucky number, and have him explain the bill.
Representative Greer.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Chairman Lockhart, yes. House Bill 26 deals with our contractor preference. Is a cleanup item arising out of the work this good body did last year. We put together and passed some good legislation dealing with defining what is a resident contractor in dealing with corporations, those business entities. There was still some gaps in that, primarily dealing with the issues of limited liability companies, limited partnerships, and so forth. What this bill does is twofold, and I think I'll just work through it because the third portion of it, I think, is the most important. The first part is, when we look on page 2, is we strike president and use the term chief executive officer so that we are dealing with that individual for any of those business entities are covered, requiring them to be a resident. Second part of the bill makes the sworn affidavits that go to the Department of Workforce Service that if those, if there is perjury done there, that there is a felony. There's some teeth put into this act. And then the third and most important part of this bill is to set up a select committee to look at the, and I would say, extensive nature of contractor preferences. As we discovered in the interim, there is a considerable crossover with the work that's been done in JAC and the Minerals Committee, and likewise how these preferences apply to the state and on down to the local entities. Again, I think to summarize this and make this short and sweet, it's a bit of a cleanup item, and then it's a directive to take a good hard look at this and incorporate this very important issue to the state of Wyoming. Representative Greer, and there is an amendment that needs to be moved. Will you move the amendment?
I will move the standing committee amendment, which my memory fails me.
I will move standing committee amendment number 1 to House Bill 26. And do so with the recommendation that do pass. Tom, help me on the amendment. I'm drawing a blank here. This is where we were in that section. Line 15. Oh, yes.
Section 2 is what we're doing.
Please forgive my memory. The standing committee amendment number 1 to House Bill 26 was an accommodation dealing with each one of our resident contractors have to certify and be certified by the Department of Workforce Services, and they have to do so each and every year. And so the workforce or so the department has all of these contractors coming in at different times throughout the year. One corporation may be in January when they file, the other may be in May. And with this change on the bill to recognizing the CEO rather than the president, the bill as originally drafted required that all those be evaluated and done by a date certain, which was going to create an undue burden on the Department of Workforce Services from their time frame. So we deleted, this amendment deletes that provision requiring these to be done within a six-month period upon enactment and allows it to continue forward under their procedures so that that evaluation comes up each year when each individual contractor's review and certification comes up.
You have heard the motion on the Standing Committee Amendment. Are you ready for the question? Question having been called, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Standing Committee Amendment number one has been adopted. We are back on the bill. Chairman Korberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would just like to have a little feedback from the Minerals Committee, I guess, on the need to what prompted them to feel the need to form another select committee on a legislative level? I'd just like to know what the discussion was regarding that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and the good representative from Thermopolis has a good question. We worked on this, and our direction was to clearly identify who these organizations were. But we also found that there were more things to look at, and so we felt like it was worthwhile to have this be an interim topic going forward to more further develop a rationale to where we work as best we can to identify those contractors that are, in fact, Wyoming contractors, give them that advantage, encourage them to do other things, including hiring those employees from the state of Wyoming as best they can to develop those skills and to develop the subcontractors at the level that they can be ongoing quality people. We couldn't get that done in the time we had for the interim this year.
Chairman Illoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd urge you to adopt this and pass this this bill. I like that one provision where you're going to continue with the select committee. I was contacted by a well-known contractor who has built many buildings throughout the state. We made a decision last year to make an arbitrary figure of how many folks that that they hired within the state of Wyoming as permanent employees. We made that arbitrary. These folks were resident contractors. We made the arbitrary number. It just happens that they fall below that by about four employees. So they've been precluded from bidding on some state contracts. They'd already bid on them. This came in. So there's a problem. We need to look at that, make sure that everybody, all the contractors, do have the opportunity to make sure that either they can comply or they want to comply or they don't want to comply. But I also want to make sure that we don't just pick a figure out of the air and hope that that's the correct number of employees. So I would urge you to continue with this piece of legislation, and I hope the committee and the select committee will take a very good look at what constitutes in-state and out-of-state contractors, because in some cases we may be now excluding contractors who have been resident contractors and now are not.
Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And the chairman of our Corporations Committee brings up a good point. We worked on this extensively during the interim, and when we heard presentations and discussions from contractors in and outside of the state as to a proper number for establishing residency, we did what we have to do often in the legislative process. We came up with one that seemed to be the most consistent, rational argument for number. That was the 15 that the good chairman from corporations mentioned. It's not a perfect number, but it was the number that we derived through the process that we worked with the contractors in the state and other interested parties. Those kinds of things we have a chance to look at now that we've got something in place and how it really does affect how many there are. We've got a number going forward. I would urge that you support the continuing select committee because there's more work to be done, but we'll stick with that 15, I believe, in this process today or this session.
Mr. Speaker, pro tem.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just had two curiosity questions. Sometimes when we set up select committees, they're usually written a little differently. It usually says, in this case, it says the speaker's going to appoint three and the Senate president's going to appoint three, so there'll be six on there. But normally, the speaker and the president pick one to be co-chair from each side, so a co-chairman. This says the select committee shall elect their chair. Makes it a little confusing, like who sets up the first meeting, and sometimes those don't always go real well, having those elections. So it might be simpler if, I just was curious if the committee had discussed that. The other question I had was a lot of times with select committees, the last select committee I sat on, that we actually could propose legislation directly. So if they came up with a bill, they could sponsor that bill in the next session. This is a little different, so it's not really, they're proposing their bills to Minerals, then Minerals proposes their bills. So it's not really a select committee, it's more of a subcommittee of the Minerals Committee. And so maybe we're not even using the right terminology. I'm just wondering if it could truly be a select committee, if there was any objection. If we took this out about going back to Minerals and let them be like a regular select committee, and if they come up with a bill, that they could be the sponsor of that bill. Just two things. Those two parts seem to be out of the norm of what we normally do with select committees, and I thought maybe there might have been a special reason why the bill had been drafted that way.
Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank the good chairman from Judiciary. We did discuss that as to the appropriateness of it. Of course, we vetted it with LSO as to the ability to have it referred back to the Minerals Committee. The fact that we have nine on the House side that heard most of the discussions, we have five on the Senate side that heard it, it seemed like that would be a good place to do the final clearing of it before it comes forward to the full legislature when we go into general session next year.
Chairwoman Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd also just stand in support of this bill and in the continuation of having a select committee. Your committee, JC, met several times this year just on public works contracts or contractor preference that we started last year with those tweaks. And really everything that you've been discussing on this particular bill has been a part of our conversation testimony, and we've had basically full rooms every time we've had a meeting on this contractor issue. So it's important for the citizens of Wyoming that we iron this out. We will be bringing a bill from joint JAC from the other side that hopefully will make it on crossover, dealing with more of the issues regarding contractor preference. So pay close attention to it, and we will hope, I hope, in the next year that we will get this thing put together. So I ask for your favorable consideration.
Is there any other discussion on the bill? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Lockhart's motion that when the committee of the whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Bill number 26 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? House Bill 26 has passed the committee of the whole. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If on your list you would add above House Bill number 27, House Bill number 11, Business Entities Revision, and House Bill 15, Insurance Surplus Lines, like to work those two bills today so that we can have the possibility of getting out a little bit earlier tomorrow. And then we will stop right before House Bill 27.
The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 36. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 36, introduced by Representative Wallace, an act relating to paramutual events. This bill was referred to Committee Number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, which recommended it do pass. Ayes, Bonner, Botten, Connolly, Davison, Yeagy, McKim, McComey, Petroff, Reeder. Signed, Representative McComey, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman McComey?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that House Bill 52 do pass. And, Mr. Chairman, I would like to turn the explanation of the bill over to the gentle lady from House District 52.
Representative Wallace.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 36, Paramutual Permits, gives the Paramutual Commission the ability to extend the licensing term from 1 year up to 3 years. It doesn't require that they do that. It gives them the option. We heard testimony from the commission in committee that it doesn't affect the amount of revenue that would be collected. If the commission chooses to give a license for 2 or 3 years, then the operator would pay the full amount for the whole years involved in that transaction. It does not affect their ability to regulate. They still have the same powers and responsibilities that they have always had. The Wyoming Horse Council, the Wyoming Horse Breeders, the Wyoming Horse Racing, all of the stakeholders are fully in support of this. This change allows the owners to the ability to negotiate better contracts and secure better financing terms. We have a new operator in the state. We had horse races this year at Sweetwater Downs, first time we'd had racing in the state for a couple of years. This is an industry that's economically diverse and involves lots of different aspects of the horse industry. The breeders in Wyoming are supported in part by revenue that is from these activities that pays incentives for Wyoming-bred horses, and that's something that we've seen diminishing in recent years, and there's a whole bunch of us who love horses and love racing that would love to see a revitalization of this industry. Note that the committee vote was unanimous. The passion, the enthusiasm, the commitment of the operator who is here now was infectious. And I think, you know, this is a good chance for us to make it a bit easier to encourage a lively, robust horse racing industry in our state and some much-needed economic opportunity and a few jobs and some great entertainment to our Wyoming communities, and I would just ask for your support.
Representative Wallace, before you go anywhere, it was pointed out to me that when the bill was moved, it was moved as Bill Number 52, not Bill Number 36. Could I get you to move it with the proper bill number?
Mr. Chairman, I would move the proper number.
Chairman McComey?
Point of order. I'll move Bill Number 36, House Bill Number 36. I thought that's what I read.
I didn't hear somebody just mention it to me, so I figure we'll cover it just in case. Representative Peterson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a little bit of background to add for the importance of House Bill 36. We have a horse racing facility about 10 miles north in Evanston that hasn't operated for a period of time because it was owned by one entity. Last year, there was no racing there, and they have sold it to another entity that came in that wants to revitalize the industry. We have every reason, faith, and confidence that they will go forward. During the period of time, I'd say the last 4 or 5 years, has been substantial deterioration in the facilities there. There need to be upgrades going forward, and therefore that's why we're bringing this 36 on, so that they can enter into longer-term contracts to revitalize what has already been spoken of. So along not only with the economic benefits that can spring forth from this particular piece of legislation, we need to look at the historical perspective of Wyoming. Horse racing industry has been a large part of it, so I urge your support of this piece of legislation.
Is there any other discussion on the bill? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman McComey's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Bill number 36 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? No. House Bill 36 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 4. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 4, introduced by the Transportation Committee, an act relating to the Department of Transportation funding regarding ignition interlock program fees. This bill is referred to Committee Number 8, Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs, which recommended that it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Bonner, Botten, Kennedy, McKim, Peterson, Korberg, Vronish, Swanitzer, Dave, excused, Blake, signed, Representative Korberg, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairwoman Korberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Bill number 4 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment. And I would like to turn the explanation of the Standing Committee Amendment and the bill over to my good colleague from House District 9.
Representative Zlonitzer.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, and thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to address the Standing Committee Amendment first, if I might. And if you read this, this is where the committee has actually lowered the cap that we were willing to allow the department to take. But in the same respect, I'd like to give a couple of kudos to the department and would like you to know that in 2010, this is the ignition interlock system bill that we're speaking of, that the average cost was about $134 per participant. In 2011, it dropped down to $114. And the estimate for this particular year is it's going to be about $99. So we felt very comfortable when we reduced the fee cap. We originally put that into place because we did not want the department to have to come back every 5 or 10 years asking for a little extra money. So with that explanation, I would call for the question on the Standing Committee Amendment.
You have heard the motion on the Standing Committee Amendment. Are you question having been called, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. The Standing Committee Amendment number 1 has been adopted. We are back on the bill. Representative Zwanitzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill basically lets the department become whole. And it takes, right now what they're doing is they're funding this program through highway funds. And what we're trying to do is make this go back to the participants who have graciously volunteered to be on this program. So as you look down through there, the first part down there in 11.7.401 basically just says that the department will establish a fee. As I mentioned earlier, they're looking at only $99 this year. You know, they're able to cut the cost as the program has become into establishment. And so they're hoping it keeps going down every year. As we get into the middle of the second page, that's where we've dropped the fee to $125, and there is an exception there for indigents that they will not be charged any money at all. And as we go down to number E, it states that all the monies will be put into account and that any money earned through interest will also be applied to that account, and all those monies will go back to pay for this program. And with that explanation, I would stand for any questions that the body may have.
Mr. Speaker Pro Tem.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick question. I'm misunderstanding, I guess, and maybe it's some explanation as to, because if I understand, because I remember when we did the bill originally, the participant has to pay for the installation and has to pay for the operation of the device on their vehicle. There's a service fee for that, and that gets paid to the third party, private party that installs. There's installers across the state. I'm confused as to what expenses DOT actually has. If you could maybe explain what their expenses are And then if maybe through testimony, was there any testimony as to how much is the individual paying already for the installation, for the monthly service fee, and then on top of that, this fee? I'm just curious, when you add all those fees together, what number we're getting to.
Representative Zoniter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And the answer to that particular question is, the first time that the participant goes onto the program, there is a fee that they would have to pay. It would be $75 for a private contractor to install the device. And then they have a monthly fee of between $60 and $70 for that device to be in the vehicle. And then the department would charge a one-time fee of $99. So when a participant comes onto this program, when you add all those together, if I used all the worst-case scenarios, it would cost them $245. And then every month after that, all they have to pay is for the monitoring fee, and that's what they estimated, between $60 and $70 per month. And that's where the participant has to come in and, you know, get their stuff monitored and checked, and all that data has to be sent to the department. As far as the department fees, they're figuring that they're going to save about a person and a half, which is around $86,000, $90,000. And then also then they have computer costs on that, and that's how we come up with that estimate for this upcoming year of being about $99 per participant.
Roman Korberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just to expound on that a little bit, the company that installs the interlock device, and then they download the information periodically. That information goes to YDOT, and it's YDOT's responsibility to monitor whether or not, how many false starts they had, why they had them. That's all YDOT's responsibility, and that takes somewhere between a person and a person and a half. Plus, they had all the computer costs for the programming, and as my good colleague from House District 9 said, those costs are going down as they become more familiar with the software and use it more and more. The computer costs have gone down considerably from when the program started. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is there any other discussion on the bill? Are you ready for the question? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairwoman Korberg's motion that when the committee of the whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that bill number 4 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 4 has passed the committee of the whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 38. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 38, introduced by the Revenue Committee, an act relating to taxation of coal. This bill was referred to Committee Number 3, Revenue, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Blickery, Camel, Childers, Madden, Peterson, Semlek, Frohnish, Goggle, excuse me, Frohnish, no, Goggles, Miller, conflict. Signed, Representative Childers, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Childers?
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the committee of the whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that bill number 38 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the standing committee amendments, and I'll have the good representative from House District 40 explain the bill and the standing committee amendment.
Representative Madden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a committee bill. In fact, it was the only committee bill that it isn't the only one we studied, but it's the only one that we brought forth this year. And it was studied over a couple of our interim meetings, and this is the product of that. Now, this isn't the simplest bill in the world, but it really isn't very hard either. But in order to explain it, you're all going to have to get a hold of that handout that came along, and it's a four-page deal that I had stapled together. And it's got some text on the front page, that says something like standard industry factor for coal. But I don't want you to necessarily look at the first page yet. I want you to look at the second page. And the second page is a picture, all right? And it looks just like this. If you see the colors and everything, it's a picture, and it's a picture of a coal mine, okay? And the first thing you have to realize in this whole process is that in order to tax coal, this is what we're going to get to here, in order to tax coal, you need to have a value of coal, all right? And this little diagram that I've given you tells you a little bit about how the value of coal in Wyoming is comes about. As you move from left to right, wait, from right to left, all right? If you move from right to left, you see that you got a coal mine there where you've got in situ coal just sitting there waiting to be mined. And then you got a truck that carries it to another point on this picture that says point of valuation. And that's known as the mouth of the mine. All right. And it's just like the term says. It's when the coal passes from below the surface, the ambient surface, to above the ambient surface. That's the point of valuation. Okay. And then after it comes up to that point, there's a series of other costs that are incurred, like processing, grinding it down, or crushing it to the right size, or whatever it happens to be, and the storage of it and the loading of it onto coal cars. So that's called, on the left-hand side, that's the direct cost charged to processing. There are certain costs associated with that. Then you've got direct costs charged to production, or, in other words, direct cost charged to the mining aspect. Okay? Now, it so happens that we do have the data, we do have the numbers for the point of sale clear at the left, but unfortunately, our Constitution says that we need to value coal at the point of the mouth of the mine. Okay? So the value of the coal at the mouth of the mine is the sum of the imputed inputs that took it up to that point, up to that mouth of the mine, all right? And that's what the mining costs are, all right? Now, the rest of the cost from the point of where it hit the surface of the ground and went to ultimately going into a coal car, that's the costs that are not included as part of the value of the coal because it's beyond that stage of the point of valuation. Okay? So, the fair market value then is the sales value that you see clear to the left, less a few deducts that are not germane to this bill, times the proportion of your costs that are mining costs compared to the total direct costs. Is everybody, well, I can't ask that question. But anyway, total direct cost is the sum of the cost to the right of the point of valuation and the sum of the cost plus the other cost to the left of it. Okay? Now, that ratio that you see there at the right side of that formula on the right-hand side of the paper is what we call the direct cost ratio. Okay? And you see that has an impact on what the actual sales value turns out to be from the standpoint of the point of the valuation point for taxing purposes. Okay? Just to make sure you understand this, take for example that you had some coal mine that for some omnipotent reason, a miracle of some type, the direct cost, mining costs, were zero because the coal made its way to the point of valuation by itself, by osmosis or something like that. Okay, if that were the case, there's no imputed value to the coal, and therefore that ratio would equal zero, so the value of the coal for tax purposes would be zero. Okay? Now you take the other obverse case is suppose that there's some way you could put a boxcars right at the point of valuation, and as it came to the top, it would simultaneously virtually drop into the coal car. So you had no processing costs required, and you had no costs of loading or anything like that. Then the direct mining costs would be the only part of the of total costs, because the processing costs would be zero in that silly case. In that case, the value of the sales would be equal to the fair market value. But that isn't the way we find it, of course. They have a sharing. They have some that are direct costs and some are direct processing costs and some are direct mining costs. And here's where it gets interesting. If we have two mines that both have 50% of their costs tied up in mining costs and 50% of their costs tied up in processing costs, then the fair market value is exactly one half of the sales value. You see that? Yeah. One half is because half of the costs are deductible and not part of the cost, the imputed cost that you count, and half of them are counted. Okay? Now let's just take another step. Suppose that one of those mines spent $1 million on improvements or incurred extra costs of mining costs such that their mining costs went up and the processing costs didn't. That direct cost ratio for that mine would go up, and therefore the sales or the full market value, fair market value, would have gone up for him. But there's more. Suppose we go to another mine down the road that increased his costs $1 million in improvements in direct processing costs. Maybe he put in a new crusher for $1 million or something. Those costs don't count as far as setting fair market value. So that ratio, DMC divided by TDC, DMC would stay the same for that guy, but TDC would go up, so his fair market value goes down. So what's the paradox here? One mine raised his cost by $1 million and his fair market value went up, and one mine increased its cost by $1 million of processing costs, and his fair market value went down. Now, what's the problem? Well, the problem is that these two mines are dealing in the same market. Okay, in other words, they're similarly situated taxpayers, incurring the same amount of costs, but because the costs are different for one mine than another, as far as the mining costs versus processing, one experiences a higher market value and then ultimately a higher fair market value and ultimately higher taxes than the other mine who experiences a windfall by lower taxes. Okay? So, what kind of other problems does this cause? Certainly, it makes one mine compared to another mine, they're not playing on the same field, right? They one of them has a longer racetrack than the other one does. And it gets even more complicated. As we look at one given firm, their costs fluctuate from year to year. So the direct cost ratio for a given mine by no means stays the same year after year. Okay, sometimes it goes up and it can go down depending upon what investments they make and what depreciation schedules they're able to experience, and the list goes on. Okay, so anyway, the problem that causes, along with the problem that some costs are subjective in nature. I was trying to think of an example a little bit ago, but, you know, say you had fire suppression equipment associated with the mine, and part of this fire suppression equipment is is responsible for putting out fires down in the pit, in which case it's a mining cost. And part of the reason you have this fire equipment is to put out fires above the surface of the mine. So there's subjective thought process that goes into this, and that becomes a problem when you, now you can start looking at the text, as long as you understand my picture here. If you look at number two here, if you set, or I should say, you imagine how we do with coal mines, just like any other operation like this, there's an occasional audits. And as you well know, audits are behind time, usually 3 to 7 years back in that general vicinity. And the auditors come in and they'll have a different view of what should be a direct mining cost and what should be included as a direct processing cost. And then you got a dispute, and all, or not all disputes, but a lot of disputes end up in court. And sooner or later, one's, either the state's going to win or the company's going to win. And in the meantime, they spent a lot of money battling each other to see who was right and how you interpret these costs and so on. So the kind of problems that can bring up is if you, let's just take, there's two possible problems here. The mine could have been accused and have been found to have not paid enough tax. If that's the case, they need to catch up on the tax, and I think there's a 18% fee or interest return for, or interest cost for a late payment, or for, because it was discovered in the audit. And there was an anecdotal example given in the testimony in the committee the other day that said that they owed some money, and it turned out that the interest penalty was more money than what the original penalty was. And you know, those kind of things are not good for the industry, and they're really not good for the state, because it costs the state a lot of money to do these audits. So that's what led us to the idea is of, you know, to make it fair across across business firms. And for example, in the Powder River Basin, there's 12 or 13 different firms. You know, if they're all playing on the same field, it would build a more competitive free market environment. Everybody would be on an equal footing. And so the question was, is there some common industry factor, in other words, this direct cost factor, that would be a good approximation for the whole industry, that they could live with that? And of course, as you know, there's going to be some that will benefit a little bit by it if they had a low industry factor, and some would be, or a high industry factor themselves, or a high ratio themselves, and those that had a lower ratio would have to pay a little more. Yeah, it turns out in the testimony in committee that there isn't a tremendous amount of variation in the direct cost ratio for across firms. So they agreed. They said, we'll take our lumps on that, and we'll just live with one factor and simplify our need to keep track of records and to catch up and to go through audits. And testimony that we heard suggested that the going through an audit process is not a very pleasant process, a very pleasant experience. So, you know, that's kind of what got us to the point that, you know, what about an industry factor, one that applies to everybody, and they know it ahead of time, and they can make business decisions in without fear that they're going to have a big argument later on, because these people are making bids selling coal to people, and all of a sudden they have a dispute and they lose a court case, and all of a sudden the bid that they made doesn't look near as good, and you know, the list goes on. So this uncertainty, it can happen to both the firm itself, and it can also happen in the case of ad valorem taxes to individual counties, because if they have overpaid, a county will have to send that money back, and that can get painful. Remember, folks, we're talking about millions of dollars in many cases here, not just not the kind of audits that I'm familiar with on my own personal level, I guess. All right, let's take a look at some of these. I think I've pretty well covered them. Obviously, number three is simplifies the annual report and the severance tax estimate. There's a what they call a true-up procedure at the end of the year where they kind of get everything together and balance, have a rebalancing, I guess. And what's some other things? The other thing is very important, I think, for an industry like coal, especially nowadays, is that it takes away uncertainty and it adds an element of predictability. And in today's business world, not only in the coal industry but in any industry, that's pretty good thing to have. The thing that we're going to benefit by, according to our agencies, is that it's going to cut down vastly on the complexity. It's going to cut down vastly on audit activities, and you know the audits are behind in all kinds of cases. I think they told us that there's either one or two cases pending right now that they don't get settled in a hurry. It's a long, drawn out process. So the final thing I'll tell you is that what criteria did we set for coming up with an industry factor? We wanted one that was going to be as close to possible as revenue neutral, all right? And we wanted it to be set, and we wanted it to be set for a significant or a not a substantial, but a fair number of years, okay? And I can go to the bill now and just show you how simple it is. If you go to page 3 of the bill, it just sets the industry factor for Powder River coal at 79%, and it sets it for the coal, there's about 3 mines in the western part of the state that have a different technique of mining and stuff and extraction, and the appropriate one for that is 81%. These numbers were based on was that we had a scatter diagrams that showed, you know, what has been true the last few years. And if you look at like the last 3 years or 4 Powder River Basin coal has varied between 78.5 to 80, it looks like. And then if you look at the West River or the Western Wyoming coal, it's been fairly stable. If you run a regression line through it and try to plot those points, it has a slight negative slope to it, but we just set it at 81%, and it seems like that's the fairest way of going about it. And the other thing that's important, if you look at Section 2 of the bill on page 3, get down to line 20, it says the department shall report its findings under this section to the Joint Revenue Interim Committee not later than November 1, 2015. What's behind this, folks, is we're going to look at what this standard industry factor brings in as opposed to what it would have brought in if we used all individual direct cost ratios for all 13 different mines, and well, actually 15 different mines, to just see how did the state gain or did the state lose. And of course, when you look at this in a projection or a forecast, you don't know for sure if you're going to gain or lose until you've had experience. And what we're suggesting here on line 22 on page 3 is that they're going to, the Revenue Committee will get a report November 1, 2015 to see, you know, how's it doing, you know, a given assessment. So that is the logic behind it. I thought it was worthwhile to go through it long enough so you could see what is behind it.
Representative Madden, there is an amendment that has been moved. Will you explain the amendment?
I have not moved that amendment. I don't have it.
Oh. I'm sorry, my bad. I thought it was moved in introduction.
I think there was one, though. What? Oh, here he is. It's this gentleman's. I guess at this point I can ask if you have any questions at this point from me, and we'll get back on this. I understand there's another amendment, and we'll talk about that in some detail.
Chairman Childers.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I've actually I said passing a standing committee amendment. There is no standing committee amendment. It's a committee of the whole. And the good representative from the reservation, I believe, has that.
Minority Floor Leader Goggles.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Mr. Chairman, I move committee of the whole amendment number one, and I'll explain that. The technical portion of it is contained on page 3 of your bill, and it is on line 8, and it changes the industry factor of 79% to 80%. And I will explain why. If you would look at your bill, it has a fiscal note in the back. The fiscal note for fiscal year 2013 totals $1,420,000. The fiscal note for 2014 totals $3,760,000. The fiscal note for 2015 is $6,390,000. For a total amount of $11,570,000. That's the industry factor of 79%. I was the no vote on the committee. My no vote was more in line with the 79% factor. I believe in the predictability of the tax liability of this bill, which it provides for the production. We are going to set into statute those two industry factors. I went back and asked the department to run some different numbers at 80%. And at 80%, the total decrease in tax liability is $512,000. And I would ask you for your favorable vote on this amendment. I believe that we're in a time of revenues, which we need to count every dollar in this state. I don't believe it's a time that we need to reduce the collection of severance tax from production in this case. We will come back in 2015 to visit those industry factors. My staff have questions, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Madden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The one thing I needed to point out is I didn't know whether to point out on page 3 there's a graph that's got some red bars and some blue bars on it, and this kind of depicts what the gentleman from District 33 was getting at here. If you look at the severance tax revenue over these projected years into 2012, 13, 14, and 15. The red lines, the red bars represent what will happen under the current bill as it exists now, not under the representative's new amendment here. And what you do see here is that, standing here today and looking at it, it looks like it's going to be those red bars are marginally lower than the blue ones, but these are projections, and coal right now is low priced and the price or the tax receipts ultimately are going to be dependent on what the price of coal is, what the demand for coal is, and things like that. But I just wanted to point that out so it gives you a perspective on the graph. That just adds to what's been said already. I just want to thank you.
Representative Lickery.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I ask you to resist this amendment. The coal industry is a bedrock that we can count on in this state for the revenue that we have. It's under attack by many entities on the federal level, and why would we want to attack them right here in our own state? So I'm asking you, please resist this amendment. The 79 and the 81 were worked out over time, and they work. Thank you.
Chairman Childers.
Mr. Chairman, I also ask you to resist the amendment. Bear in mind that one of the main reasons this was done is because there's an effort to reduce the audits. And it does that. It does exactly what we're trying to do. And the money issue will be straightened up later, I believe. But I would say vote no on the amendment.
Mr. Minority Floor Leader Goggles.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In part, this legislation erodes the future tax base of the state by changing the calculation here. The fiscal note makes clear Wyoming will take in nearly $12 million less from coal extraction through the year 2015. That's less. We're putting it in statute. We have not done that for anybody else to reduce their tax burden. So I ask you to vote for this amendment.
Is there any other discussion on the amendment? Representative Madden?
Yeah, just a statement on that, neither for or against it. But, you know, the logic behind the 80 is somewhat rests in the fact that over the past 3 years, it's been around 79 to 80 in that general area. But if you look at a spread diagram over the years, because the mines are getting into deeper coal, the mining costs are going up, which you come up with a perverse outcome that as their costs are going up, the taxable value goes up also. And I think this is one of the appeals on the part of the industry is that it's nonsensical the way, you know, it's the only business they know of or I know of where your costs go up. The more your costs go up, the higher the taxable value of the product you're producing. But it's going up. I should have passed this around, but there's a scatter diagram. The direct cost ratio is going up, but it's not going up monotonically. It does go up, you know, up and down, but it's gently going up. But that's the reason that the blue lines are a little bit taller than the red lines on that picture I just showed you, because we're assuming that direct cost ratio is going to follow that trend line. That's the only thing. Thank you.
Representative Connolly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm in favor of the amendment, I think, and a question for the bringer or the sponsor or the good representative, our economist. It seemed to me that your presentation was talking about the need for having a tax industry factor, and that the bill was designed so that it would be revenue neutral. And then when we look at the graph on page 3 with the red line, with the red bars being slightly less than the blue bars, we're not right there. It seems to me that the amendment brings us closer to the blue bars with the 80% rather than the 79%, which seems to me to get more to the revenue neutrality that you talked about in your presentation. Am I confused?
Representative Madden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe not confused. Maybe I didn't give you the whole story. The blue lines, the reason they're going up is because it's assuming that the direct cost ratio for firms would continue to go up because the mines are getting deeper and their costs are getting higher as their mining costs are getting higher as it goes on. If that happens, the direct cost ratio keeps going up, which means there's a bigger chunk of the sales value of coal that is ultimately used as the base for taxing the severance tax. So, you know, if you were sure enough that that direct cost or that the direct cost ratio for individual firms on average is going to go up the next 4 years, then you're right. But if someone else here says, well, I don't think it is, then they're right. You see what I mean? It just depends on what you're assuming under the condition of the blue line. If you follow the regression line and you have faith in that, based on the scatter diagram, you know, yeah, but I don't have that much faith in it. You know, I think it's going to go up, but I don't know.
Representative Miller. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just a point of clarification, what the bringer of the amendment said is accurate. The revenue as the tax is collected now will continue to go up with the increasing cost of mining this very same coal as it gets deeper. That's just the way the calculation is made by the Department of Revenue. That is counterintuitive to reality. At some point, the coal companies may get more aggressive in protesting this. In fact, they would have to. Once they start having to strip at 10 to 1, 20 to 1, 30 to 1 strip ratios, their costs are going to go through the roof because the royalty, the severance we charge on this stuff, is going to continue to go up when it should really be staying the same. It needs to be valued at the mine mouth. And they have this convoluted way of valuing it now that's in litigation almost on a continuous basis. The industry, the department have all gotten together and tried to vet this out and come up with a solution. For the first year or two, they're actually going to be paying slightly more than they would be paying the way the law is right now. But as the stripping ratio gets deeper and deeper, they've set it at 80% and it can't go up beyond that point anymore. And so it actually helps the long-term viability of the industry. So, again, you vote the way you want, but I'm just trying to clarify this a little bit. It is a tax increase. If you support the amendment, the department and the industry kind of agreed to the bill as is. And just a reminder, 10 years ago, I believe this industry paid about $400 million into the state coffers. Last year, I believe they paid $1.2 billion. I think they're paying their fair share.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There was an economist and a chemist and a physicist on a desert island, and a can of beans washed up. And the physicist said, you know, if we heat this can of beans, or if we put this can of beans between rocks and take a pole and lever long enough, we can pry off the lid and we'll have some beans. And the chemist said, you know, we can sit it in the fire, and if we raise the temperature of the beans to a certain temperature, the lid will pop off and we'll have some beans. And the economist said, well, let's just assume we have a can opener. There are so many assumptions in the graph that you see from here into the future that relying on these figures is a dangerous thing, up or down. You assume coal mines in the Powder River Basin started in the creek beds. I was corrected yesterday. It's not river beds, although we call the Belfouche River a river. But they started where most of the overburden got washed out downstream, and the stripping ratio was cheapest on the coal. Well, as time has progressed, we move further and further to the west, and the coal gets deeper and deeper and deeper. It gets more and more expensive to mine the coal. The price of coal necessarily has to go up with the more expense that we mine the coal. Well, the way that we tax coal now, we have this perverse equation that also increases the taxes, making the coal more expensive because it's more expensive to mine, and we tax it more at being more expensive to mine. And so you all know basic economics. If you increase the price of coal in an industry that is already under attack, don't assume that your coal sales are going to be level, which is the next assumption, that coal sales are going to be level. I can tell you from meeting with legislators from other states, our biggest customer in coal at 63 million tons a year is Texas. And the Texas legislators tell me that since they have lots and lots of gas in Texas, they would prefer to convert all of their electrical generation to gas. So you've got an industry in this state that's threatened, and you've got an amendment that's going to make it harder and harder for those folks to sell coal, and every 1% decrease in the price of coal is $20 million off, or not, volume of coal sold is $20 million off of the bottom line of this state. So be very, very careful in increasing your taxes on an industry that's already under attack.
Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A comment, and maybe I can frame it in the way of a question. This is a work product of a lot of people that are involved in the industry and understand the complexities, and we've heard a very extended description of what's in the bill. But basically, the issue is being driven by the Department of Revenue to get a fair value for the coal that is being produced now and in the future. And it was driven by them way more than our kind of messing around with things on the edge. So I would encourage you to defeat the amendment and then to pass the bill, because it is a bill that I think is in the long-term interest of the state because of the effort that was put into it by an interim committee in detail going forward. So that's my encouragement on the amendment and the bill.
Is there any further question being called? All those in favor of Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
The amendment has failed. We are back on the bill. Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Shoulder's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a recommendation that Bill Number 38 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 38 has passed the Committee of the Whole.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Miller.
Privilege of the floor.
Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, it's not often we get visitors and constituents from Fremont County, but you're all lucky today. We have a pair. Up in the South Gallery here, we have Jerome and Stephanie Hutchinson from Riverton. He is the artist goldsmith that's created the item that the legislative spouses are going to give to the governor's wife tomorrow. So please welcome them to the People's Chamber.
The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 2. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 2, introduced by Representative Peasley, an act relating to the service of process fees. This bill was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary, which recommended it do pass. Ayes, Perbuto, Brechtel, Brown, Kennedy, Green, Crone, Nicholas, Peasley, excused, Throne, signed Representative Brown, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Brown?
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill 2 do pass, and I would defer the explanation of the bill to the representative from House District 3.
Representative Peasley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I bring this bill to you humbly in an effort to show how simplicity can be beautiful, to show you how a simple, slight adjustment to our statutes can make things all better. The word biennial with an A means every 6 months. Biennial with an E means every 2 years. This particular statute requires a review of the service fees for the service of process by the Board of County Commissioners. This is an act that the sheriff goes through when he serves papers. I would like to give the same academic dissertation as we heard on the previous bill as to the reasons for my suggestion on this bill, but I think if it doesn't make sense to you, then just don't vote for it. It's just an adjustment. It was something that came to my awareness years ago when I was county attorney, and I just suggested to the sheriff's office and the commissioners to ignore it and read it the way it was obviously intended, and this bill just gets it back to that. So I ask you to take this piece of art and pass it along. Thank you.
We have a committee of the whole amendment. Mr. Speaker Pro Tem.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the amendment, committee of the whole amendment number one. If you look at the statute, what this is dealing with is civil process. So let's say you want to sue someone. Someone has to go and hand the documents to that person, and there's usually third-party private companies that do this too, but also the sheriff can do it for you. And many people use the sheriff. And there are some statutes that actually specifically say the sheriff has to do it. So the sheriff can charge a fee to do it. And usually most sheriff's department has one deputy that's assigned. They do civil process throughout the day. The sheriff can charge up to $50. So we set a maximum, but the sheriff can actually charge less than the 50. Most counties charge the full 50. Here's what you get for your $50. You get three tries. Meaning the sheriff's going to go knock on that door or track down that person three separate times. The fourth attempt and every attempt after that is $10 more each time. Usually within the first three attempts, they can usually find the person. So for $50, what you're getting is service. Because we set the maximum penalty, the maximum fee that can be charged by the sheriff at 50, some counties could choose to charge less. If they so chose. However, most counties have just moved straight to the 50 because it's good revenue, and it actually does take some work. You're actually probably that 50 is probably a low number, but that's a different bill. The deal here is the amount, anywhere from, I guess it could be zero, anywhere from zero to 50 is set by the county commissioners. They don't need to make. It's great that what the representative is doing here is definitely needs to be changed from at least every 6 months to every 2 years. But more importantly, they really don't need to meet. They only need to meet the initial time that they set the fee. Now, if they ever change it ever again, sure, have a meeting and change it. But once you've gone to 50, why would you keep meeting every 2 years to just agree to keep it at 50? You're not going to do it. So what this amendment does, it deletes both words. It takes out biannual and it takes out biennial. It takes both words out. So it just reads now to be determined and set by the Board of County Commissioners. So they wouldn't have to come back and visit this every 2 years. They just set it once, leave it at the 50, and then if anybody ever wants to change it, they would come in and petition to change it. That's all the amendment does. Otherwise, you're going to have the county commissioners having to meet every 2 years, and to be honest with you, I'm not sure if many of them actually do that. Thank you.
Representative Peasley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That too, Brutus. So my work of art has been spliced upon. My year of preparation for this big moment, my single bill, my sole sponsorship, no co-sponsors, this work of art, I feel like Duchamp in Paris when Picasso showed up and showed him a better work of art. Indeed, I reluctantly concede that my sweet touch of gossamer has been replaced with the scrubbing pad of the politician, and probably rightfully so. In all those words, I guess I am conceding this is a friendly amendment that is hard to swallow. Thank you.
Are you ready for the question? Question being called. All those in favor of Committee of the Whole Amendment number one, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Committee of the Whole Amendment number one has passed. Is there any further discussion on the bill? Question being called. All those in favor of Representative Brown's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that bill number two do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no?
No.
House Bill 2 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 12. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 12, introduced by Representative Brown, an act relating to real property, marketable title act, conservation easements. This bill was referred to Committee Number 1 Judiciary, which recommended it do pass. Ayes, Barbudo, Brown, Kennedy, Green, Crone, Nicholas, Throne. No, Bechtel, Peasley. Signed, Representative Brown, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Brown?
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill Number 12 do pass, and I will explain the bill. This is a modification to the Marketable Title Act, and the operable language in that act is found in 3410103, which says any person having the legal capacity to own land in the state and has an unbroken chain of title of record of any interest in land for 40 years or more shall be deemed to have marketable record title to such interest subject to certain things. There is some reservation in the real estate community, which frankly I don't share, but if anybody shares it, then it becomes a concern on the viability of the chain of record and good title, marketable title to property. And there's some concern that this Marketable Title Act might eliminate the reservation or the encumbrance on property that's created by a conservation easement after 40 years. So then the Marketable Title Act contains a number of exceptions in 3410108, things that are not extinguished or barred or compromised by the Marketable Title Act, and this would add conservation easements to the list of items that are accepted, or in other words, that the Marketable Title Act has no application to. So the end result of this would be to eliminate even a threat or even a hint of a threat to a conservation easement from the Marketable Title Act, and would be sure that people who give conservation easements take the tax benefits and encumber their property have no concern that after 40 years something might be triggered by the Marketable Title Act that would reverse the whole transaction, which would have devastating results on the donor of the or the seller of the conservation easement. So, Mr. Chairman, I stand for questions, and if there are none, I call for the question.
Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Brown's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it just do so with the recommendation that Bill Number 12 do pass, please say aye. Those opposed, no?
No.
House Bill 12 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration, Chairman Brown, are you? Okay. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 13. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 13, introduced by Representative Brown. An act relating to property regarding wind estate disclosure. This bill is referred to Committee Number 1 Judiciary, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Barbudo, Bechtel, Brown, Kennedy, Green, Crone, Nicholas, Peasley, Throne. Signed, Representative Brown, Chairman.
You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Brown?
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill 13 do pass, and I will explain it. There is a laundry list of matters found at 3411151 that a seller is required to disclose to a buyer. That is capable of being waived, and in many instances where a professional is involved, a realtor or an attorney, in fact, those required items are waived. In other words, the buyer says, you don't need to make disclosure to me. However, in the absence of a waiver, those things have to be disclosed. And we have worked on that list over time. The most notable, I think, in there is that a seller must disclose if fee ownership of the underlying mineral estate has in any way been severed in the chain of title from the surface estate. And you may recall that was borne out from concern that too many people were purchasing property without fully understanding
that they were buying the surface only and that there was a mineral estate, which was the dominant estate, that could override uses of the surface to the extent that use of the surface was required to get the minerals out. Now we have a situation where we considered the matter of severing the wind estate from the surface estate. And in the last session, we passed a bill, which is now law, which says the wind estate cannot be severed from the surface estate. So that is not going to happen in the foreseeable future. However, before we passed that bill, some wind estates were severed from the surface estate. And that leaves a trap in there. Those severances are grandfathered and are going to exist for all time. And they're a very small subset of all the properties that change hands. But the fact that they're a subset and the fact that it's going to be, with the passage of time, become more and more obscure, makes it more and more important that people not be trapped by this brief interlude we had when the wind estate could be severed from the surface estate. So this bill simply adds to the laundry list of things that a seller of a property must disclose to the buyer unless there's a waiver. Now, if there's a waiver, then it doesn't have to be disclosed. That's usually if there's a realtor involved or an attorney. Now, in addition to that, those severances have to be recorded in the title commitment, and so that would constitute a notice from the seller to the buyer. If the seller is required to provide the buyer a commitment for title insurance and the severance of the wind estate is of record in the county records, then the title commitment's going to go to the buyer, and he's going to, if he reads the exceptions, he or she reads the exceptions, they're going to see, oh, okay, the wind estate's been severed here. That leaves even a smaller subset of property transactions that are not handled by a professional and are not made with the use of title insurance, and therein lies a small, very small subset in which a purchaser from the property could just make a purchase not understanding that there is a burden on the property which may be totally contrary to the use they intend to make of it. So for that, and that's where I see this bill really addressing the problem. So this adds to the laundry list and says every seller of vacant land shall provide to a prospective buyer a property disclosure statement that includes, and then I would add, a severed wind estate. And as I say, that's only going to occur in a small number of cases, but the fact that it's small means that it's even more of a trap for the unwary. And the safety valve on it is that it can be waived if a knowledgeable seller and a knowledgeable buyer are making a transaction. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd stand for questions.
Chairman McComey.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just curious here. So if I'm trying to get something of my mind around something. If I bought this property, I didn't know about the wind estate. I built my house and some other things, but then the people that had the wind estate, excuse me, could come in and make me move my house, or they wouldn't have any kind of damages they'd have to pay me, or what?
Chairman Brown?
Mr. Chairman, that would depend on the wording of the severed wind estate, and probably they wouldn't have to move the house, but they might have a wind tower constructed in their front or backyard. And that's when the fireworks are going to go off, and they're going to say, you know, this isn't fair, I wasn't told, I didn't know, blah, 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 blah.
Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Brown's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Bill number 13 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 13 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 11. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 11, introduced by Representative Brown, an act relating to business entities, revisions. This bill is referred to Committee Number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, which recommended that it do pass. Ives, Bickery, Bird, Illaway, Yagi, Croker, Patton, Roscoe, Stubson, Swanitzer, Dand, signed Representative Illaway, Chairman.
So I suppose when we're done with this one, we can say that our bill goes to 11. You have heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Illaway?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill 11 do pass. There are no amendments, and I would like the good gentleman that we've heard from endlessly from District 14 to explain the bill.
Chairman Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill involves two fixes to the work we've done the last few years on the Corporation Act and the Limited Liability Act, Company Act. In the Corporation Act, we enacted a section, 1716.14.23, which provides a mechanism to appeal a denial of reinstatement to the district court. Now, how does that happen? Somebody has a corporation on which they don't do something they're supposed to do. They either don't keep the registered agent current, or they don't pay the fee, or they don't designate their officers or something, and so the corporation goes into administrative dissolution. Then they try to reinstate the corporation. And for whatever reason, the Secretary of State denies that, probably because they do it incorrectly. But who knows? So under 1716.14.23, if the Secretary of State denies the application for reinstatement, then that exhausts the administrative remedies, and the person who seeks reinstatement can go to court and contest that issue with the Secretary of State in the district court. When we enacted the limited liability company statutes, we neglected to put the same appeal procedure in there. So this goes to a section in the limited liability company statute 1729707, which was a reserved section. And in that reserved section now puts in a reference back to that corporation thing. So at the same process of appealing a denial of reinstatement that exists in the corporate statutes also exists in the limited liability company statutes. In addition, we put the same reference in the statutes that have to do with registered agents so that if the Secretary of State denies reinstatement of a registered agent, it kicks back to the same appeal process. That then creates consistency between corporations, limited liability companies, and registered agents about what the remedy is if they cannot persuade the Secretary of State to reinstate the corporation after there has been a denial by the Secretary of State. Now, the second fix involves, wait a minute, I got, this bill is a little bit difficult to read. The second fix involves the new Limited Liability Company Act that we enacted last time. And there is some language in 1729.1103 that makes no sense in our situation. This was caught by an attorney last summer who inquired about it, and we looked at it, LSO looked at it, and we have drafted the fix. So if anybody's interested, which they probably aren't, in 1729.1103, the last part of it says, if power to amend or repeal the statute under which the limited liability company was organized was reserved. That was a part of the Uniform Act that was drafted to address a situation in some states where the state constitution would not allow the amendment of an act unless the right to amend it was reserved in the original enactment. Our Constitution does not read that way. That makes this language superfluous and makes it very confusing. So this statute simply removes that superfluous language. The other thing it does is this statute said, made reference to its effective date, and LSO, while we were doing this, just said, well, the effective date was July 1, 2010, so instead of saying the effective date, they put in the hard date of July 1, 2010. So it's not really a substantive difference in that. So with that explanation, Mr. Chairman, I'd stand for questions, and if there are none, I'd call for the question.
Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Illaway's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Bill number 11 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? House Bill 11 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There were some unintended things this afternoon. You all can apply to LSO for 1 hour of economics credit. Later in the afternoon, I move that the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
You have heard the motion. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion carries.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion carries. The reading clerk will read the Committee of the Whole report.
Mr. Speaker, your Committee of the Whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, beg leave to report as follows. House Bill 10, recommended do pass. House Bill 25, amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 52, recommended do pass. House Bill 26, amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 36, recommended do pass. House Bill 4, amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 38, recommended do pass. House Bill 2, amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 12, recommended do pass. House Bill 13, recommended do pass. House Bill 11, recommended do pass. Signed, Representative Croker, Chairman.
Mr. Speaker, I move the adoption of the Committee of the Whole report.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion is adopted. We are at that order of business reports from standing committees.
Mr. Speaker, your Committee number 1, Judiciary, to whom is referred House Bill 55, respectfully reports sending back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Barbudo, Brechtel, Brown, Kennedy, Green, Crone, Nicholas, Peasley, Throne. Signed, Representative Brown, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your Committee number 1, Judiciary, to whom is referred House Bill 70, respectfully report sending back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Barbudo, Brown, Kennedy, Green, Crone, Nicholas, Peasley, Throne. No, Bechtel. Signed, Representative Brown, Chairman.
Any re-referrals? Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'd like to re-refer House Bill 27 to your committee number 2, Appropriations.
The motion is to re-refer House Bill 27 to committee number 2, Appropriations. Hearing no objections, it is so referred. Committee announcements. Chairman Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee appropriations will hear House Bill 41 and House Bill 27 upon adjournment. They are both re-referral bills.
Chairman Childers.
Mr. Speaker, your committee number 3, Revenue, will meet Friday, February 17th, 8 a.m., Room H11, to consider two bills, House Bill 51, Industrial Siding Impact Payments, House Bill 40, Optional Sales Use Tax Uses.
Chairman McComey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 6, Travel, will meet tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. in Room H10, where we will take up House Bill 87, Mixed Martial Arts.
Chairman Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 1, Judiciary, will meet Friday morning, tomorrow, February 17, in Room H8 at 9 o'clock a.m. to consider House Joint Resolution 9, Mandatory Judicial Retirement.
Vice Chair Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 8, Transportation and Military Affairs, will meet 15 minutes after adjournment today to take up 3 bills. House Bill 21, exceeding the speed limit while passing. House Bill 22, Gold Star License Plates. And House Bill 46, Handicap Parking Space.
Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 9, Minerals, Business and Economic Development, will meet tomorrow morning at 7 a.m. Room H18 to hear the following 4 House bills. 28, Environment and Quality Council Executive Secretary, House Bill 29, Uranium Research Funds Extension, 90, Baseline Scientific Assessments, and Joint Resolution 1, Resolution to Support ANWR Energy Development.
Your committee number, Chairman Harvey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, will meet tomorrow, February 17th, 10 minutes after noon recess in Room H17, where we will be hearing House Bill 82, Public Assistance Drug Testing.
Your committee number 12, Rules, will meet today upon adjournment, Room 302, to consider House Bill 31, Obsolete Laws and Proposed Rule Changes. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The hope is to adjourn early tomorrow. I guess that depends on debate. General file for tomorrow will be House Bill 15, House Bill 27, House Bill 50, House Joint Resolution 3, House Bill 54, House Bill 63, House Bill 5, House Bill 16, House Bill 55, House Bill 70, and such other bills as may be referred. Mr. Speaker, I move that the House adjourn until tomorrow, Friday, February 17th, 2011, at 10 a.m.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The House will be adjourned until Friday, February 17th, 2012, 10 a.m.